Hello and welcome to episode 3 of The Bloody Pit. My name is Rod Barnett, and this being an odd-numbered episode, I am here again to talk about some of my favorite movies. I'm labeling this my second 10 favorite movies, but let's be honest, past the top 10, my feelings on these movies get a little bit more nebulous, and although I do love all of these movies, trying to arrange them into some kind of order, favorite to least favorite, even in this minor range, gets really difficult. So, here's 10 more movies that I love, 10 more of my favorite movies, and I think after this I may have to divide my lists of this type into genres just to make things more interesting. Even though you'll notice from this list that there's a couple of science fiction movies, 3 westerns, and, well, we'll talk about them as we get here. Let's just say Errol Flynn makes another appearance. Well, guys, hope you're enjoying this. Please remember to try to get a hold of me if you want to. You can write at thebloodypit@gmail.com. I will try to respond to all your emails, and as a matter of fact, I'll respond to the emails that I've gotten from the first couple of episodes later on in this show. So sit back, enjoy it, and we will talk to you again soon. Copy right there. 1982 was an amazing year for genre cinema. The number of astonishing movies that got released that year is brain-bending. You look back and so many of the movies from that summer, that entire year, are some of my favorite movies. Much like this one. For years, people had been thinking about trying to find a way to adapt some of author Philip K. Dick's novels to the big screen. It has now been done 40 years on, or should I say 30 years on, with some success and some failure. It's amazing when you think about Philip K. Dick's stories and just how odd and strange they are, even on the written page, that so many people really do want to try to adapt his work. But Dick is one of those amazing writers who, as you read his stuff, you understand what he's doing while he's doing it to you, and you can't stop yourself from reading them. They're so inventive, so twisty, that at any point in the story, you can be thrown a curve that changes your perception of everything that's come before it and makes you wonder if anything that comes after is going to be what you ever thought it could possibly be. It is his ability to write wonderful stories and create strange characters and odd circumstances that always have made people want to adapt his work to film. Well, the first real big adaptation of his work was Blade Runner in 1982. And it is probably, let's just call it, my 11th favorite movie. I did not get to see it on the big screen. I wish I had. That was a time in my life when I was first able to actually start going to a whole lot of films with my father. My parents were going through a divorce, and one of the things that we were able to do on the weekends with my dad was he would take us to the movies. And we saw a lot of movies. But we didn't get to go see Blade Runner. Bad choice there for us kids. But we were the ones pulling the strings. We got no one to blame but ourselves. Of course, since then, I've probably seen Blade Runner in excess of 50 or 60 times in my life. and I've owned it on so many different video formats that I actually fear for them to create a new video format, because I know I'll end up buying it in that way as well. The first way I ever bought Blade Runner was on Videodisc. That's not Laserdisc, folks. Videodisc. Kind of like an LP. Yeah, yeah. Early video was rough, folks. Very, very rough. Should have stuck with VHS. Anyway, Blade Runner is an astonishing film, and if you don't know the plot, I won't tell you too much about it. It's based on kind of the first chunk of Philip K. Dick's novel, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, and is wonderful. If you're a fan of the movie, or even if you're not a fan of the movie, and have never read the original source novel, let me recommend that you do. It's an astonishing piece of work, very entertaining, and will really give you a different slant on a lot of different things, including the film, the story they chose to tell on screen, and their characterization of Deckard, the central character. Visually, Blade Runner is an unassailable classic, kind of modeled on Metropolis in a way, which has kind of a built-up look to it. The retrofitted style of the film is one of the great visual elements that influenced so many movies afterwards, and it's just impossible to talk about Blade Runner without talking about the way it looks. But much like Metropolis, this built-up urban environment where the wealthy live in these huge high-rises where the poor, the workers, kind of the lower classes, all live in these kind of run-down buildings left behind by rich folks long ago. You can see in the design of these places where the less-than-wealthy people live, the opulence of the past that has just been left to go to seed so that the rich can go somewhere else. Of course, the thing that draws me to Blade Runner so much is not just that it is a science fiction film, but that they decided to use the noir, the film noir, as a touchstone for this story and a way to visualize things and as kind of a plot to wrap Philip K. Dick's story around. Now, in Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, the central character is a kind of policeman. But as it's played out in the film, this is very much a kind of private detective story. A kind of... Deckard is kind of a private investigator brought in by public officials to do a nasty job. Essentially a hired assassin. It's a dark, dark idea, and one that the film kind of glancingly pays attention to at the beginning and then gets deeper and deeper and deeper into it as it goes along. It's often been criticized, especially at the time it came out. Remember, Blade Runner did not do well financially. Its huge cult status these days is something that, of course, I think is deserved, but is very strange in retrospect. Well, I'll stop talking about Blade Runner for now. Let me just recommend that if you are a fan of the film and have never read the book Future Noir by Paul Salmon, let me point you toward that book. It's a fascinating book. It's actually one that I'm thinking about rereading here very soon. It gives you a lot of information about the production of the film and just everything surrounding it, and is well worth your time if you're at all a fan of Blade Runner. So let's see. That's one film on this list directed by Ridley Scott. Careful, because he's going to show up on this list again. Number 12 is easily the most recent film that you're going to find on this list. And when I was compiling this kind of 11 through 20, it was a bit of a shock to realize that this film was going to end up on it for various reasons. One, it's a film that actually stars Brad Pitt, and that would make it the second film in a listing of 20 films that I love that star Brad Pitt, which is something that I just would not have thought would have been true. Not that I dislike Brad Pitt particularly, but, you know, come on. Brad Pitt. Anyway. Number 12 is Inglourious Basterds. That is Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds from 2009. When I had heard years ago that Tarantino wanted to make a World War II action film. I thought, yeah, I understand the urge. Hey, I'm a big fan of World War II combat comic books and kind of pulpy World War II style fiction, and I'm a big fan of World War II cinema, war cinema in general, big rah-rah stuff, even the really jingoistic stuff I can kind of get behind at times. But the idea of Tarantino making a World War II film just didn't seem, it just didn't seem right. But I could not believe how good Inglourious Basterds turned out to be. Now, I'm a huge fan of the film that originally had that title, spelled differently, of course, by Italian filmmaker Enzo Castellari, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. And I'm a huge fan of that film. I think it's wonderful. It's you can call it a macaroni western or a spaghetti war film. It's just such a great war movie, and it's told with such energy, and it's clever. And Tarantino didn't remake it, which is the beautiful part. He took the kind of spirit and the idea of making a movie of that type from the original film and made his own. As a matter of fact, he did what he did so well with Kill Bill by taking the things that he loved about exploitation movies and Eurotrash cinema and crafting something bigger, finer, and just so damned entertaining. Inglourious Basterds stuns me. I love the fact that you can subdivide it into separate chapters. I think that it has one of the most brilliant opening sequences of a film in years. As a matter of fact, I think it has one of the most brilliant opening sequences simply because he took the tone and the idea of that kind of opening from Once Upon a Time in the West and grafted it onto the beginning of this. The first part of the movie takes place in 1941, and then you segue into 1944. And, of course, there's a reason for it, but that sequence is just so good. I could babble on and on about Inglourious Basterds and make a gibbering moron of myself, but I think that it's just such an amazing film, and it's one that I find myself desiring to go back to repeatedly. It's so damn much fun. And the neatest thing to me is that you realize it's an alternative history. By the time you get to the end of it, you realize, okay, wow, we are really in we're really in crazy land here, because there's no way to even pretend that this is reality. Not that completely insane or impossible things happen, but things that clearly did not happen in reality occur, and it's just so damned entertaining. This is a movie that is not only about entertaining you, but about commenting on how it's entertaining you, and entertaining you in a way that makes you realize you're being entertained while thinking about how you're being entertained, and maybe getting a little deeper than that as well. It's my favorite Quentin Tarantino film. I've enjoyed pretty much everything he's ever done, and I'm stunned by the fact that maybe one day he'll do something better than this. I don't see how. If he'd done nothing else with this particular film, if he'd done nothing else but bring us Christoph Waltz in a role that he deserved to be nominated for an Oscar for, if he'd just done that alone, he'd be worth, patting on the back and going, good job, man. But he brought every bit of talent that man has. Every bit of Quentin Tarantino talent is present in the writing of this film. It's literate, it's tight, it's funny, it's sharp in ways, and contemplative in ways, and intellectual in ways. Not that it doesn't have a couple of failings. There's a couple of little bitty missteps here and there. I'm not altogether sure that one little piece of casting should have been done. It's such a fun film. If you've never seen Inglourious Basterds, I highly recommend it. If you're at all a fan of exploitation cinema of the last, 40 years or so, you're going to see things in it. And if you're just open to good cinema, you're going to see things that will stun you. Brace yourself. It's a very violent movie. And also, I've mentioned Christoph Waltz, but honestly, the best performances in the movie come from the females in the cast. They are so freaking good. Diane Kruger and Melanie Laurent are so good in their roles. they're stunning. It blows my mind how good they are in this movie. But I'm going to stop babbling about it. Number 12, Inglourious Basterds, the most recent film you'll find on this list, and just one hell of a movie. Number 13 on this list is, maybe appropriately enough, a horror movie. And it's one of my favorite horror movies of all time. Oh, man. I am an unabashed fanatic about the Universal horror films of the 30s and 40s. I love every one of them. They're a joy. Even the worst of them is something that I've probably watched in excess of 7, 8, 9, 10 times. They're so much fun. There's something about them that speaks to me in a way that no other group of horror movies probably ever will. I love horror movies from every decade, every year. There's just amazing stuff out there from every era. But those Universal horror films, those black and white classics from the 30s and 40s, they created so much of what is right and wrong for me about horror film in general and how these things unfold on screen. The film I'm talking about, absolutely one of my favorite films and my favorite of the Universal horror films, is not one that generally is very well known because it does not star one of the big monsters. It doesn't have one of the monster characters. There's no Dracula, no Frankenstein monster, no mummy, nothing like that. The film I'm talking about is from 1934, and it's called The Black Cat. Now, with that title, if you know nothing about it, you would think, hey, is that based on the Edgar Allan Poe story? No, it's not. It's not even close. They essentially took the title, played the Poe name up to get publicity, but that's all. That's really all it is. The big thing you need to know about this is that this film stars Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi. And it was the first of about, I think, 8 films that they starred in together. And for my money, it's easily the best. This movie, it's 1 hour and 5 minutes long and packed into that 65 minutes is everything from necrophilia, drugs, torture, I mean like almost on-screen torture, Satanism with a black mass, talks about a human sacrifice. There's a morbidity that hangs over every inch of this film. It's just a stunning, stunning film. It's not as well known as it needs to be. Let me read this off to you. The film starts off with a honeymooning couple, Peter and Joan Allison, vacationing in Hungary, when they learn that due to a mix-up in the reservations, they must share a train compartment with Dr. Vitus Verdegast, who is Bela Lugosi. He explains that he is traveling to see an old friend, an Australian architect. Verdegast has left his wife to go to war 18 years ago and has spent the last 15 years in a prison camp. The three of them end up going to his Austrian architect friend's house when their bus crashes, and when they get there you realize that Verdegast and his buddy Polzig, who's played by Boris Karloff, aren't really buddies. And as a matter of fact, it looks like since that Lugosi's character was thought dead, his buddy played by Karloff has married his wife/widow,
and has a daughter with her. And that's where the weirdness begins, and it just gets stranger from there. This is an incredibly creepy film. Amazing sets, beautiful black and white photography, and Lugosi and Karloff have never played off of each other better than in this film. I mentioned that they are the heart and soul of the film. They are the stars, but what's so funny is that the characters who would generally be considered in a normal, logical horror film as your main characters would be the vacationing, honeymooning couple, and you don't give a damn about them because they're just victims being played with by Karloff and Lugosi, and even at one point playing a game of chess to see if one will kill them and the other save them. And even that distinction between them at one point seems rather arbitrary because they're so caught up in this hatred of each other for the things they've done to one another over time. I read about this film and learned about this film before I got to see it. Years ago, I got my hands on Gregory Manx's book. I think it's Tom Weaver's book, Universal Monsters. I'm sorry, Universal Horrors. Man, I can't get this right. Universal Horrors. Great book. There's a new edition of it out now that's expanded on it, which means I'll probably need to rebuy the book eventually, but they're so damned expensive. But anyway, I was reading that book and had not yet seen The Black Cat and read about it in there and read about the infamous skinning scene where Lugosi has Karloff's character tied to a cross and has taken a scalpel and is skinning him on screen. And I read about how the director, the great Edgar Ulmer, had been forced to go back and reshoot this sequence because it was too disgusting. Remember, this is all pre-code. This was done before the problems that came in and made them institute the Hays Code and therefore kind of lock down on some of the sex and violence that they were getting away with heavily in the early 30s when the talking film age came into being. And they made them re-film that. So as soon as I read this whole thing about them having to redo a scene because it was too disgusting and that it was a torture scene and this guy was being flayed alive and they're still going at each other verbally while this is going on and all this horrible stuff, I was like, I've got to see this film. And I have to admit that when I finally saw the movie, it exceeded my expectations. I really did not expect it to be as good as it was. The Black Cat from 1934. If you are a horror film aficionado at all, see it. If you think you've seen Todd Browning's Freaks, and therefore you've seen like the weirdest thing that the 1930s horror movies can throw at you, well, okay, Freaks. Maybe Freaks is a little weirder, what with its cast of real freaks, of course. But The Black Cat is a dark, fun, mean-spiritedly entertaining horror film unlike anything you've ever seen since. It's a great movie. The Black Cat from 1934. Let me just highly recommend that you check it out. Next up, another horror film, this time a science fiction film, and one that moves us from the 1930s all the way up to the 1970s. 1979's Alien. That's right, my second Ridley Scott film for this list, so bear with me, that's just the way the cookie crumbles, ball bounces, every cliche you can think of. I love Alien, and I've watched it so many times, it's just mind-bending. It's also one of those films that I've owned on multiple formats, and I'd really kind of rather not think about it. What can you say about Alien that hasn't been said? I mean, we now even have a kind of bizarre prequel done by Ridley Scott called Prometheus that just came out this year that, while flawed and desperately needing a longer running time, reminds you why
you loved Alien. Alien is really, really good 1950s style science fiction on film, done with a much bigger budget, a better design concept, and the knowledge that what you're doing is supposed to be creepy and scary and exciting. Alien is, well, it's just a great film. I mean, when you think about its humble beginnings and how close it came to being filmed on the cheap by Roger Corman, you just kind of got to be thrilled with how it came out. And think about all the things that Alien has given us. First of all, I'm one of the rare people who actually like the sequels. Well, I like the sequels until we get to those god-awful Alien vs. Predator films, which are abysmal beyond all comprehension. Alien. Back to Alien. My mind wanders, of course. There's nothing about Alien that I dislike. Even after having watched it a bazillion times and studied it and gone through documentary footage and interview footage where people talk about the making of it, and I can spot the problems and I can spot the flaws and I can spot where they used footage from one thing to fix a problem here, there, yon. Even with all those things, Alien still entrances me. It's one of those movies that I cannot imagine not watching at least every few years just because it is so astonishing to see. I mean, it's radical in, if nothing else, its look. Of course, the H.R. Giger-designed monster is, well, I don't think there'll ever be a better monster design on film. I don't think we'll ever get anything even remotely close to as good as that is, or as just shocking as that thing is. I mean, all it turns out to be in reality is a modified man in a suit, but it is so good and puts so much of the crap that passes for special effects these days to shame, because once we graduated to CGI, we lost something, people. It takes a real filmmaker to use CGI effectively, and you've got to use it with practical effects to make it work. Otherwise, it just comes off as a cartoon, and there is nothing in Alien that screams cartoon. It is completely wonderful and totally effective. One of the funnier things about Alien to me is Ridley Scott's confession that essentially what he was trying to do was kind of craft a version of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre for science fiction. He saw himself constructing something that was built the same way that movie was structured. And when you realize that, it kind of makes sense. It is structured in the same way as the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, with similar kinds of beats past a certain point. Another great thing about Alien is that it was one of the very first, well, probably not the first, but it was the first one that I ever saw, the first film that I ever saw that introduced its characters, its entire cast, as being regular Joes, regular people. These weren't rocket scientists. They weren't soldiers. They were working guys. They were blue-collar folks. They were, hey, just there to do their job, get their pay, maybe negotiate a little bonus if they could, and move on. Because that's who they were. They weren't heroes. They weren't supermen. They were just guys doing a job. Made them automatically easy to relate to and automatically some people that you actually cared about in a different way than you might care about a hero or a big, well, superpowered person that can automatically do certain things better than you or I. These were just folks who maybe got along, maybe didn't get along, had their problems. It was nice. It was fascinating. And it became wonderful to see that done more and more over the next few years in other films. Peter Hyams' Outland is a good example of this kind of thing. Those blue-collar versions of what people were going to be like in the future carried through into other movies, and this being, like I say, I think there were other films that did that before, like Silent Running. But this is the one that I first saw, the one that really affected me, and the one that made me think, wow, I've not quite seen that before, because I was so used to things, you know, films that had, you know, the big hero, or even just the big anti-hero, kind of larger-than-life characters. These guys are not larger than life. Alien
will always remain one of the most effective horror films ever produced, I think, because there's nothing about it except for, well, except for the computer screens, which really look dated these days. But it is still effective. It still works. I can attest to this because just recently I showed it to a 15-year-old, and although he felt that it took too long to get started, which is kind of the typical thing that even Ridley Scott was worried about when he first put the film together. As Ridley Scott said, nothing happens for the first 45 minutes, which is not true. But for an impatient audience, yeah, nothing happens for the first 45 minutes except that you're being shown all this amazing stuff. You're being shown this place, this stuff that you've never seen. It's a whole new world. It's a different thing. And that ship becomes a kind of character, especially once it turns into a haunted house with a monster creeping around it. But it'll always be an incredibly effective film, and regardless of how you feel about any of the sequels, even the prequel, Prometheus, it is one to return to because it's incredibly well done, beautifully textured, and wonderful to get wrapped up in. It is a great film, and that's why it's on this list. Next up, the first of, let's just say, at least two westerns on this particular list, 10 films. This one from 1968 or 1969, depending on what country you were seeing it in. This is, without a doubt, my favorite western of all time. It's an astonishing film. It's one that I've talked about many times and have actually mentioned in this podcast already once before. It's Sergio Leone's film Once Upon a Time in the West. Leone had made three excellent westerns that, in my opinion, had just gotten better with each successive film. Fistful of Dollars, which was a remake of Yojimbo. For a Few Dollars More, which is my sentimental favorite of those of these first three films, known as the Dollars Trilogy. And then the mind-bendingly fantastic The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which is, well, legend.
if you don't know the good, the bad, and the ugly, then you've just not been paying attention or haven't listened to a conversation that referenced pop culture in the past, 40 years. But the film he made right after that, the last Western he directed, well, okay, not really. He did direct one more Western, but he did it kind of, even though he didn't want to. But his last gigantic scale Western, Once Upon a Time in the West. He was recruited by Paramount and was allowed to come over and actually make this one in the United States, in the deserts of Utah, where John Ford shot some of his classic Westerns, such as Stagecoach and all those different films. So he was able to actually play on the grounds where the filmmakers he was imitating had crafted their classic Westerns. And he took the opportunity to build this huge, huge story. Much like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, this is a big, 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 big story with lots of moving pieces and parts represented by different actors playing certain characters. Some would almost say certain character types. And each moving part intersects with the other, and it becomes this very mythic thing. And of course, the beauty of it is, he just slowly introduces you to this stuff, lets you see it, and then it slowly starts to come together. It is, it's a great old story. It really is a standard Western story of a man who has bought a lot of land because he knows the railroad's going to come through. Essentially thinks he's setting himself and his family and his new bride up for this amazing future where they'll be rich and kind of be on the ground floor of this town that's going to be a railroad stop in the new railroad. But then things go horribly wrong. But of course, because there is a very wealthy man who's not above ordering them killed to take the land from them. Once Upon a Time in the West is a long film. There's two or three different cuts of it, depending on where you see it. Go for the longest cut. If you've never seen it, see the longest cut because it is elegiac. It's gorgeous. It's poetic. It's lyrical. It's astonishing. Did I mention the cast? Oh, man. Charles Bronson, Henry Fonda, Jason Robards, Claudia Cardinale, a truly beautiful woman. This was the first movie I ever saw her in, and she's just so ravishing. And if you think you know Henry Fonda as an actor, but you've never seen Once Upon a Time in the West, trust me, you don't know anything about him. Henry Fonda plays the villain in this piece, a murderous, evil man. And let's just say that as soon as you're introduced to him, you know that this man is beyond redemption. It's an amazing performance, and it's one of those things that you are kind of stunned by. I mean, if you come to Henry Fonda through his later roles like on Golden Pond, or even his earlier roles like The Grapes of Wrath or something like that, this is something you've never seen Henry Fonda do, and he's really, really good. I'm a huge Charles Bronson fan, and I absolutely love his character here, just kind of referred to as Harmonica. And of course, there are dark connections between certain characters, including Bronson's character and Henry Fonda's character, that link to the past, and we get these wonderful flashbacks. Leone was a genius, if in no other way, in style. And there are scenes in this movie I cannot imagine anybody else pulling off in quite the same way as he did. There's a gunfight near the end of the film. And the symbolism, the violence, all melding together, it's just a great film. If you've never seen Once Upon a Time in the West, please allow me to suggest that you do yourself a service and see it. It is fan-freaking-tastic. Next up is a film noir. And I guess in a way you would call this my favorite film noir, since it's the only one that's ending up on this list. But I have so many favorite film noirs, it's kind of a difficult task to choose. Well, it would have been a difficult task, except I just love this film so much. The movie is The Big Sleep from 1946. I am a huge fan of the book the movie is based on and the film. Of course, I came to the film first. And I came to the film first because I'm a huge fan of Humphrey Bogart. But this is also the only Humphrey Bogart film on this list of 20 films that I'm doing over these two podcasts. So you can see how these lists are not quite perfect and quite a strange animal, no matter how you slice them. Anyway, if you've never seen The Big Sleep, how to sum it up? 1946, basically, Philip Marlowe, played by Humphrey Bogart, is hired by a new client named General Sternwood. He has some questions. Basically, it ends up that there are several problems the general wants Marlowe to investigate, and they all revolve around the general's family and his two daughters. Now, the two daughters are both extremely attractive women. One of them is played by the luminous Lauren Bacall, and she's probably the least trouble. It's the younger one who's the real trouble. Carmen Sternwood. In the novel, Carmen's, let's just say, been posing nude for a pornographer. They have to kind of skate around that in the movie version. A lot of this stuff turns out to revolve around, essentially, the good general trying to find out what's happened to his favorite employee who has mysteriously disappeared. The general isn't completely forthcoming with Marlowe, which adds to the problems as he investigates these things, and it's just a fantastic detective story. I love old black and white detective stories of just about every type. Even a bad one can really entertain me, and The Big Sleep is easily one of the best. Now, I love this movie beyond all comprehension and have watched it a zillion different times. I've watched it, well, I remember the old clamshell VHS case that we had around the house when I was in high school. And believe me, that got watched a lot. Wow, this is really also the only Howard Hawks? No. Oh man, it's a Howard Hawks film. Oh, I love Howard Hawks films. If you've never seen Red River, I'm not going to talk about Red River. The Big Sleep is fantastic, and one of the things that has kept it on my mind the past few years is the realization, and revelation really, that there are two different versions of the film, and if you buy the DVD of the film, you get both versions. Essentially, they had completed the film The Big Sleep, but the studio was holding it back because it was wartime, and the war was winding down, and they wanted to get a lot of these films that they had produced that had wartime themes out into theaters, and so they were holding The Big Sleep back because it didn't really matter. It didn't have a wartime theme, so they could put it out later on and be assured that it would probably make money. But in that intervening time, there became to be a lot of information. Basically, the public became aware that Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall were an item. As a matter of fact, they eventually became married. And they decided, hey, let's refilm some of the movie before we release it and emphasize their relationship in the movie, kind of beef it up and change a few things here and there. So there are officially two different versions of the movie. The version they originally shot, and then the version that we've known for decades, with those reshot scenes with things a little bit different. There's a difference of about 20 minutes between the two versions of the film, even though the movies are almost the same length. And what's fascinating to me, as a movie nut, of course, is to have two different versions, essentially two variant adaptations of that fantastic novel in one spot with the same cast. And it's absolutely fascinating. If you get the chance, watch the version that got released and then watch the version that they originally shot. Both are fantastic films and both tell the story. But what's wild is that the version they originally shot is a little clearer in the storyline department. That's always been one of the funnier things about this movie, is to put it nicely, the plot of The Big Sleep is a little complex. And that complexity comes from two things. One, the stuff that they reshot necessitated that they remove a couple of different things that should have been in the film. And one of the things that gets removed in the version that was around for so long is a scene where there's a lot of dialogue between Humphrey Bogart's character and another guy that kind of lays out what is known at that point about what he's investigating. And without that scene, things get a little muddy. But another thing that gets a little muddy is there's a murder that you never really are sure. Well, you're never really sure about a particular murder's who committed the murder. You're never really sure about a particular murder and who committed it. And what's funny is that goes all the way back to the novel, where not even Raymond Chandler was really positive. The guy who wrote the novel was not even really positive who killed this particular character. And it could have been one of two different characters. And the movie doesn't really nail it down. But what's funny is the first time I saw the movie, maybe even the second or third time I saw the movie, I didn't even think about that fact. It's that good. But if you've never seen The Big Sleep, I highly recommend it. It's a fantastic detective story, a wonderful film noir, and God, it's got great performances across the board. The Big Sleep. Check it out. My goodness, for number 17, let's talk the only Christmas movie that ends up on my list. I love Christmas movies. If you're interested in Christmas movies, allow me to direct you toward a great book called Christmas Time at the Movies. I'm sure you can get your hands on it pretty easily. I'll try to provide a link on the page with this podcast, but it's a fantastic book and it's great to go through. I disregard a lot of the opinions in it because I tend to disagree with the authors on several of the movies that they praise and several of the movies that they denigrate. And one of the ones that they denigrate, or at least give short shrift to, in my opinion, is this film, Scrooge, from 1970. That would be the musical version of the story, A Christmas Carol, starring Albert Finney and Alec Guinness. I am not much in the way of a fan of musicals. As a matter of fact, years ago, I was such an anti-fan of musicals that I disparaged them openly. But I have mellowed with age. When I was younger, there were really only three musicals that I could tolerate. The Wizard of Oz, because I saw it as a kid and didn't really think of it as a musical. Singing in the Rain, which is such a damn good movie that it's just ridiculous. And if I did another listing of 10 movies, Singing in the Rain would end up on that list. It's a great film. And this movie, Scrooge. This is my favorite Christmas movie. It is an absolute joy from beginning to end. And Albert Finney is the perfect Scrooge. His Ebenezer Scrooge is amazing in its detail, perfect in its nuance, and there's a reason he won the Golden Globe for this performance. Now, I've seen other people do Ebenezer Scrooge on stage and on screen, and I've seen some really good performances. And I've seen some that some would argue are better than Albert Finney. But for me, Finney embodies Scrooge. He is wonderful in the role. He's dark, he's mean-spirited, he's cruel. And when he makes his turn at the end, as the story winds to its inevitable conclusion, you can believe his turn. What's great is that this movie also has these wonderful flashbacks to a younger Ebenezer Scrooge. And we see him grow older. we see the events that make him into the embittered, money-grubbing scumbag that he is as the story starts. And it's wonderfully played, both as a young man and as the older man. And I always loved that years ago, more than a few people remarked to me when we would discuss this movie that for years they thought that there were two different actors playing the older Scrooge and the younger Scrooge, and only sometime after seeing the movie did they learn that it was the same actor, just in old age makeup. Vinny is fantastic in it. And, of course, so is Alec Guinness, playing Jacob Marley. But don't forget the wonderful ensemble cast, and it being a musical, don't forget the songs. Lots of wonderful tunes. Some of them, once you've heard them, you'll never get them out of your head. Thank You Very Much is one of the greatest musical songs, or should I say, songs written for a screen musical or stage musical. This was a stage play, of course, at first. It's great stuff. If you've never seen Scrooge and you shy away from musicals and that's why you haven't seen it, let me recommend it. This is a great one, and it is, like I say, is one of the few that I tolerated back when I turned my nose up at musicals just in general. Scrooge is wonderful. It always puts me in the Christmas mood. It always makes me happy to be alive, happy to be, well, surrounded by the people that I love and that love me. Scrooge is a wonderful movie. I watch it at least once a year. You should too. Check out Scrooge. You'll be glad you did. Number 18 is another Western, and one of the best films I've ever been able to see in a movie theater in my life. 1969's The Wild Bunch, by director Sam Peckinpah, is my favorite Sam Peckinpah film, which is saying a lot, considering how many fantastic movies he made. But The Wild Bunch I always come back to as my favorite because it appealed to me when I was younger because of its violence, its storytelling slickness, its revolutionary editing, the way it was shot, the beauty of it, the fact that I'd never quite seen anything like it. But the film is even better to me as I get older because the themes that are in the film and kind of obvious to anybody who pays any attention to the story about getting older and what that means, especially when you've lived a life where you're not putting down roots, you're not establishing a family, you're not doing those things that a quote-unquote normal person would do, and your life is wrapped up in violence, and you can't find a way out of it. All those themes, and many more, have a tendency to make it mean something different as you get older. But if you don't know what The Wild Bunch is, it's an odd Western in that it takes place in a much later period than most Westerns do. It takes place in about, I think, 1913 in Texas around the Mexico border. It stars William Holden, Robert Ryan, Ben Johnson, Warren Oates, Ernest Borgnine. It's about a group of men who are essentially outlaws who are trying to find a way to retire from their life. They're getting up in years, and they just want to hit one final score, which they think is going to be the robbery of a railroad office, and that goes completely to hell for them at the beginning of the film, and a lot of citizens who have absolutely no reason to be killed get gunned down as they are ambushed by lawmen who have somehow become aware that they were going to try this robbery. From there on, they once again attempt to find a way to get enough money so that they can quote-unquote retire, all the while everybody, each one of them really kind of knowing that this life has run its course. It's a very violent film, as a matter of fact. That's what most people are going to remember about it the first, second, or even third time they see it. The graphic bullet strikes on human bodies and Peckinpah's desire to show what real violence is like and to not shy away from it is one of the things that got this movie into a lot of trouble and made it become, you know, a film that got really trimmed up and edited down over the years. Luckily, nowadays, of course, via DVD or Blu-ray, you can see the full-length cut of the movie. And it is easily one of the greatest Westerns ever made. I think it's mind-bendingly good and something that everybody who is a Western fan should see. And if you haven't, you ought to. I am a huge fan of Sam Peckinpah's movies. If I had to pick a second favorite of his movies, it would be a toss-up between his earlier Western, Ride the High Country, or possibly Cross of Iron. But Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia is also way up there. I recommend the vast majority of his movies. I'd stay away from Convoy, because it's not really particularly good. But the rewards within his, well, almost all of the movies he made, the rewards within them are so deep and so wide. He seems to have never made a film that he couldn't find a way to put something in that meant more to him and therefore made it eventually more universal for other people as well. He knew what he was doing. He was a consummate filmmaker. He may have reveled in violence and used violence for various and sundry means, and I understand there are people who would level the charge of misogynist against him, and there are some stories that would point to him possibly being kind of mean-spirited toward women at times. But I think the work stands up. It stands up again and again. And if you ever have any doubts about what kind of person he was, watch his film The Ballad of Cable Hogue right after watching The Wild Bunch, and you will see two very different sides of this filmmaker, this creative person. You won't find a better movie than The Wild Bunch. You won't find a better Western. And as long as you can deal with the violence, which was really harsh, especially for 1969, you'll see one of the best movies you'll ever see. My sombrero, all the limbs of a tree coming home, sweetheart darling, just my rifle. Hey, there is a second Howard Hawks movie on this list, because we're talking now about Rio Bravo from 1959, which is, strangely enough, the only John Wayne film on this list. I love Rio Bravo. This is a great film. I only recently learned it's actually based on a short story, which means I want to try to track that thing down and read it eventually. Rio Bravo stars John Wayne, Dean Martin, and Ricky Nelson, and Angie Dickinson, and Walter Brennan, and Ward Bond, and all of them are fantastic in this movie. It's a Western set in a small Texas town. John Wayne plays the sheriff of the town. Dean Martin is one of his deputies, a deputy who has gone on quite a lengthy bender after a failed romantic relationship, and that's how the story starts. What ends up happening is they end up having to arrest a particular no-goodnik whose family really does not want him arrested or put in jail or put on trial, and the story is of them trying to hold on to their prisoner while other people try to bust him loose, while they're waiting for the circuit riding judge to come by and take this problem off their hands. That's really what it boils down to. It is one hell of a great film. If you've ever seen a really well-made 1950s Western, you'll know what to expect. And if you know Howard Hawks as a director, you know he's going to deliver it very effectively. Rio Bravo is, well, it's a movie I've watched repeatedly. It's quite long. It's a little longer than it probably needs to be. And I think you can account for that because there's a couple of song interludes. We get a song from Dean Martin. We get a song from Ricky Nelson. They're folded brilliantly into the story because these guys end up holed up in the jail, trying to wait out the people who want to break in and break out their prisoner. And of course, what are you going to do? I mean, we're talking the late 1800s. You're going to sing songs, you're going to tell stories, you're going to shoot the bull. And there, that's how the songs are folded into it, which is pretty ingenious. Along with those songs is a really great score by composer Dmitri Tiomkin. I always love when he shows up in the credits of a film, because I know that no matter what, if it's got a Tiomkin score, I'm going to have something to enjoy in this movie, regardless of anything else. If you've never seen Rio Bravo, I've already given you the outline of the plot, and that really is the story of it. And what's great is that when the movie winds down, it ends up, as you would expect, in a rather violent gunfight. But along the way, there are these wonderful, well-written, well-played set pieces. One or two involving actions that go down in a bar that are just fantastic. But the real joy in this is this fantastic cast bouncing off of each other with really great dialogue. Even though I do also love the rather explosive ending of the movie as we start blowing things up with dynamite to keep things under control, if you can follow the logic of that. If you've never seen Rio Bravo, do check it out. It's really good. It's easily my favorite 1950s Western, and there were a lot of really good Westerns made in the 1950s. And number 20 on this list is a film I've enjoyed since childhood. The Adventures of Robin Hood from 1938, starring Errol Flynn. Oh, wow, if you've never seen this. Now, don't get me wrong, there have been a lot of Robin Hood movies, some good, some terrible. This is my favorite. I've enjoyed quite a number of others. As a matter of fact, I've really enjoyed getting to know the Hammer productions from the 60s of various Robin Hood tales. They've actually been fun, too. But this one's the granddaddy. I should also mention that I do like the 1922 version that starred Douglas Fairbanks. That's a good film, too. But The Adventures of Robin Hood with Errol Flynn is so much fun. Adventures? That's the correct word for the title of this film. This thing is one series of fantastic, exciting events after another. I mean, just one, line them up. Go, 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 go. Got everything from the exciting archery, the sword fighting, the humor, which is a blast. You got an amazing cast of characters. You have Flynn starring for the third time on screen with the luscious, luminous Olivia de Havilland, who's just absolutely beautiful. And you've got a great story. I mean, the Robin Hood story is one of those classic tales. You can't beat the Robin Hood story. If you do it right, it's fantastic. You can go light, you can go dark, you can make a comedy. Well, you can't if you're Mel Brooks. You make a pretty bad movie. But that's beside the point. I won't talk about that. The basic plot is, of course, Richard the Lionheart, King of England, is taken captive. He's on the Crusades. He's out. He's left England. And his brother John takes power, proceeds to oppress the commoners, especially the Saxons. He raises their taxes, supposedly to raise a ransom for the king, but in reality, he's just trying to store up money to secure his own position. Only one guy stands in his way, and that is Sir Robin, Earl of Locksley. When things don't go particularly well when he confronts John, and he's essentially made into an outlaw, he gathers a group of merry men around him, and they start waging guerrilla warfare from their base in Sherwood Forest. What more do you need to know? Oh, man. First of all, the movie has great villains. Anytime you've got a film where Errol Flynn is going up against Basil Rathbone, as Basil Rathbone plays the Sheriff of Nottingham in this film, you got a good movie. Of course, that final sword fight between the two of them is probably even a little bit better than their sword fight in Captain Blood. Very exciting. This movie was shot, well, it has two listed directors. The main one that should stand out in your mind is Michael Curtiz, who is a fantastic director who made a lot of movies. He made Casablanca as well. And, boy, talk about a film that probably should have ended up on this list of 20 movies, Casablanca. Anyway, once again, I'm diverting myself. The Adventures of Robin Hood is a very fun, incredibly entertaining, beautiful Technicolor film. That's one of the neat things about it. It's one of the earliest films that I'm a huge fan of from this era that is in this bright, beautiful Technicolor. Lovely, lovely movie. I couldn't tell you how many times I've watched this. I first taped it off television years ago, painstakingly cutting the commercials out of it. And it never ceases to amaze me how entertaining and fun this movie is. I love introducing it to other people. And it has such an amazing score. If you've never seen a Robin Hood story, I'm sure you've probably seen a Robin Hood story. This is the one to go back to because this is the one that almost all of them play off of. Even if they go back to a lot of the written records or legends about the story of Robin Hood, this is the movie that almost everyone references in one way or another because it's just kind of become ingrained in our mental way of looking at the character, our way of thinking about it in cinematic terms, and there's a reason for that. If you see the movie, you know what I mean. Something else if you haven't seen the movie, or even if you have, one of the neater things to take note of the next time you're watching the movie is that all that archery, all that stuff, all the trick shots, those were really done. What they would do is they would pad up stuntmen and have the archer, the badass archer who was doing all the trick shots, they'd have him actually shoot them with arrows and just pad these guys up so that they wouldn't be hurt or killed, which is an astonishing thing to learn. But that just makes all those arrow shots even more impressive because they weren't tricking them up with wires or anything like that. They were actually doing the shots. It's just, that's just amazing to me. But Adventures of Robin Hood, number 20 on this list, and one of my favorite movies. All right, folks, time to wrap this podcast up with a little feedback we've gotten here at the old Bloody Pit. Let's see, got two pieces here. Got one from correspondent Mark. Mark has been a regular writer to the sister podcast or brother podcast of the Bloody Pit, which is, of course, the NashyCast, the podcast about the films of Paul Nashy that I do with my buddy Troy, who, if you've been listening diligently, you will have noticed joined me for the Your podcast along with my buddy Jeff Nelson. Please see episode 2 for a lengthy, perhaps far too detailed discussion of Your, the Hunter from the Future. But Mark has been writing in pretty regularly to us and keeps us on our toes, and that's always nice. And so he took a listen to my first episode and sent me this feedback here. He says, "Hey, Rod, really enjoyed your first podcast. Giving us your top 10 is a great way to launch a new series. Of your 10, there are 3 I haven't seen. Shockingly, one of them is Citizen Kane. I know, and I call myself a film fan. I've also not seen the Three Musketeers films or Captain Blood. Maybe I'll have to rectify that. You certainly made them sound fun. Personally, I think I'd drive myself insane trying to come up with a definitive top 10, so here's 10 of my favorites, all of which would be in my all-time top 20, but whose places in the chart fluctuate constantly. In alphabetical order, although if pushed, I would probably put Dawn of the Dead at number 1. Okay, here's Mark's 10 that he lists here. Dawn of the Dead, 1978. A Clockwork Orange. Hidden Fortress. Ooh, good choice. Kill Baby Kill. Napoleon Dynamite. Nightmare from 1981. Salem's Lot. Stalker from 1979. Tales from the Crypt from 1972. And Wild Style from 1982. He says, "I also enjoyed your review of the latest Tron film, which I haven't seen. I wouldn't call myself a fan of the original, but I bought the Blu-ray recently and enjoyed it well enough. For the first 10 minutes or so, it was touch and go, but I settled into it and it was good fun. Watching the extras, it's amazing how little of the film is actually computer-generated." I think he must be talking about the first Tron film. He says, "Okay, I'm done here. There's a biscuit crumb under the E key on my keyboard and it's driving me up the wall. Looking forward to Bloody Pit number 2. Thank you, Mark, and I hope you enjoyed the Your podcast. Definitely an odder podcast, considering the length and the fact that we go into the full 3-plus-hour version of Your the Hunter from the Future. But thank you for your feedback. If you've never seen Citizen Kane, yeah, you call yourself a film, yeah, see Citizen Kane. You will be glad you did. And the Three Musketeers and the Four Musketeers, can't recommend it highly enough. And Captain Blood is also a wonderful film. If you're a film fan, I can't imagine not loving those movies. Then again, maybe there are people out there who don't like swashbucklers, but I can't imagine those people. I have to admit, though, I did have I was taken aback recently when one of my new bosses at work listened to my podcast and took it upon himself to watch Captain Blood. And, I think it may have almost poisoned the well for our relationship. He did not enjoy it. And when I asked him, well, when you realized you weren't enjoying it, why didn't you stop it? He said, I have to finish them. I have to finish them once I've started them. And I was just like, okay, well, man, I can't help you there. It's my favorite movie. It doesn't have to be anybody else's. Of Mark, of your list, of your top 10, Nightmare, the horror film from 1981, I keep thinking I've seen that movie, but I think I probably have not. I need to get my hands on a copy of that. Stalker is a fantastic movie. It's the Russian science fiction film. Quite a good movie. Very minimalistic, but of course it's from the director of Solaris, so that's pretty much what you've come to expect. Kill Baby Kill, a fine Bava choice. Can't argue with that at all. Clockwork Orange is a great film. Hidden Fortress, wonderful. As for Wild Style from 1982, never heard of it until your list, and I'm wondering if you were joking, considering that from what I can understand, Wild Style is it a documentary about legendary New York graffiti artist Lee Quinones? Or Quinones? I guess it's Quinones. Or is it a documentary? A drama? I don't even know. Oh, no, it can't be. Fab Five Freddy's in it? Grandmaster Flash? Mark, you're British, so I'm assuming that you're just fascinated by the early days of hip-hop and rap. That's just all I can figure. I've never heard of Wild Style before in my life, and it sounds completely crazy. Other than not having seen Nightmare yet and not knowing what the hell Wild Style is, the only real disagreement you and I would have is with Napoleon Dynamite, which I understand lots of people love, but it did not make me laugh. And although I do like weird humor and strange, odd things, Napoleon Dynamite just didn't trip my trigger. I know it does for a lot of people, but it just didn't work for me. But hey, that's what top 10 lists are all about, is starting conversations.
So once again, thanks for writing in. Another piece of email here from Brad, fellow podcaster Brad, who does Hello, It's the Doomed Show with his partner. He says, Rod, I just got around to listening to your first episode, and I really enjoyed it. I know you have loads and loads to say outside of the Nash universe, and I'm glad you have another forum along with the blog to get your thoughts out there. Captain Blood is now in my queue after hearing it is your favorite film. I have The Adventures of Robin Hood on Blu-ray, and it is high time I explored Mr. Flynn's filmography. I foolishly thought I could send you my top 10 favorite films list, but as much as I love making lists, the task was far too daunting. I will say Halloween is my favorite film of all time, and there would be Truffaut, Bogdanovich, Welles, Hitchcock, Wes Anderson, and Christopher Guest on there. That would make for a pretty damn good list, I have to say. Anyway, back to Brad's email. He says, I'm glad to see Citizen Kane on your list. That film is fresh today. I have the Blu-ray with the Amazon-exclusive copy of The Magnificent Ambersons, and I figure you know the story, but Welles said that if the studio hadn't taken it away, Robert Wise, I'm looking at you, it would have been better than Kane. Anyway, I'd love to get your thoughts sometime on Ambersons. Lastly, thanks a million for playing our promo on the show. It means a lot to us. I look forward to more of The Bloody Pit of Rod. Well, thank you very much, Brad, and my thoughts on The Magnificent Ambersons. I wish we could somehow see what Welles would have turned it into in the editing room. I don't really blame Robert Wise. He was really kind of put into a bad position to have to edit. When, honestly, I lay a lot of the blame at Welles' feet. I mean, he's the one who ran down to South America to play, you know, let me get some sex all over the place while putting together some kind of half-assed idea for a film. I like The Magnificent Ambersons. It's the weak sister of those first two films that he made. I mean, it's nowhere near as good as Kane. It's nowhere near as good as Kane, and everybody knows that. And it would be nice to know what it would be, or what it could have been, I guess is the best way to put it. And yeah, you do need to explore more of Errol Flynn's filmography. He's got a cool dozen movies that I think are just some of the best things you're ever gonna lay your eyes on. Fantastic stuff. And as you can tell from this episode, I couldn't get through another listing of 10 films without putting The Adventures of Robin Hood on the list. So I do love Errol Flynn movies, people. Oh, and I forgot, Mark did write back after the Your podcast. I completely forgot. So three pieces of email, but okay, two correspondents. This is from Mark. He says, hey, Rod and friends, apologies for the tardy feedback. Great podcast. You people are obviously all good friends, and the relaxed atmosphere made for a really enjoyable listen. And Your, in either version, sounds like fun. Think I'll have to seek it out. Yeah, go do it. Go do it. And back to Mark's email. He says, it was nice to hear you give Antonio Margheriti the respect he deserves. Although he was never a big name like Argento or Bava, his filmography is incredibly consistent, with barely a bad film to his name, much like Enzo Castellari, who is similarly unappreciated. I'd love to see a Bells and Whistles DVD of Margheriti's Web of the Spider. Supposedly, Margheriti preferred Castle of Blood, but for my money, Web is the better film. And it's got Michel Mercier in it. Do I need to offer any further evidence? Yeah, I see what you mean. He says, it was also nice to hear Hitchhike get a mention. I really love this film. It's beautifully photographed and has a great cast and script with plenty going on under the surface. Also, Morricone's score is fabulous and bloody difficult to find. Take my word for it. Well, I'm not sure what film the next Bloody Pit will be covering. Did I miss it or did you mention it? But I'll certainly be up for the ride. All the best, Mark. P.S. Thank you, Troy, for mentioning that you want to be Telly Savalas' lollipop. I'm going to need a Brillo pad to scrub that image out of my head. Yes, Mark, that was, let's just say I was not expecting to learn that about Troy, my podcasting buddy Troy, while doing a podcast about Your. And, by the way, Mark, thank you for the kind words. Jeff, Troy, and I had a really good time doing the Your podcast. It's a film we love, that we just feel doesn't get nearly enough love, even in the cult film community. It's just almost never talked about outside of, you know, very small Eurotrash loving circles, and it's a movie that I think needs more attention, which is why we wanted to do that podcast on it and why we decided to take our time and delve into even the long version of it. Agree with you about Castellari. Enzo, I mean, everybody knows Inglourious Basterds now, but there's just so many good films made by that man that it's ridiculous. You can just keep going through them and going through them. And Margheriti's Web of the Spider, of course, Web of the Spider is Margheriti's own remake of his film Castle of Blood. Just a few years after he made it, he made the same story twice, making him one of the few directors to actually pull such a stunt, along with Hitchcock and a few others. And a very, very good film. I like both versions. I would really like to see a good, just even a letterbox, just to, you know, so we can see the entire image of the film. All I've ever seen is a very cropped, panned and scanned version of the film, and I'd really like to see the whole damn thing one day. And yes, I agree with you. Hitchhike is a fantastic movie from top to bottom. Any film with Franco Nero and David Hess and Corinne Clary has really got to be something somebody needs to pay attention to. And I've never gone hunting for the score, so that's interesting to know. I wonder if I did some poking around, maybe I could find the score to Hitchhike. But once again, Mark, thank you for your feedback. You are certainly a man of constant feedbackiness, and for that, I thank you immensely. You help us keep things on track, and you really make me think about certain things, and you've pointed me in a few interesting directions, so please keep it up, my brother from another mother across the pond. Well, folks, I think that's going to wrap it up. I'd love to be able to tell you exactly what episode 4 is going to be, but I've got a few different, well, I've got a few irons in the fire. I'm not really sure which one's going to come out yet, blazing hot and ready for action. But in the future, I do think we have planned a few interesting episodes. I'm hoping to do a kind of Christmas episode before the end of the year. I don't know if I'll be able to make it. We've got a kind of Ramones-centric episode on the horizon with a new podcasting partner, somebody who wants to dip his toes into the podcasting waters, so keep your ears peeled for that. Other than that, please remember you can contact me here at the podcast at thebloodypit@gmail.com. Please feel free to drop me a line. If you don't want your email read out on the show, please be sure to let me know about that. Otherwise, it's fodder for the show, people. Something to get me talking about something else. So, once again, thanks. Please feel free to write in. Let us know your thoughts. And if you've got some ideas for shows, people are also writing in with ideas for shows. And I think that's fantastic because, trust me, I will eventually run out of ideas all on my own. Or, well, no, I won't run out of ideas. There's too many things to talk about, and I'll babble endlessly. So thanks again for listening in, folks. We will see you again here, like I say, intermittent. You never know when an episode of this is going to pop up in the feed. I'm just hoping I'm able to get, it's been a couple of months, so I'm hoping to get the speed of production up a little higher than it has been. Thanks for listening, folks, and we will talk to you again later. I'm Rod Barnett, and go watch something fun.
Deadlier than Dracula, wilder than the werewolf, more frightening than Frankenstein. You'll see a creature of the damned, damning the living to destruction when you see the horror work of the She-Beast.
unknown.